Recently, I interviewed sports attorney Darren Heitner. Now, I do want to apologize for my giddiness during this interview, but you have to understand, this was nirvana for me. I'm talking law and sports. I mean, throw in some Arthur Bryant's barbecued ribs, and I am ready for the next level. Beam me up. Well, here is the interview. Well, this week, we have a very interesting special guest, Darren Heitner from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. He is a partner of Heitner Legal. He is a contributor, writer for Above the Law, a very funny website. If you care about the crazier side of the law, check out Above the Law. He has written for Sports Money, the section in Forbes magazine. He created and writes the Sports Agent blog, a great wealth of information if you care about things sports and legal. And you want to know, hey, show me the money. Where does that money go? How do you get the money? Check out the Sports Agent blog. He covers it all. He has appeared on ESPN, CNBC, CBS News, all to talk about the issues of sports business and sports law topics. Darren, I got to say, you are a TV movie in the making. Thank you so much for joining us today. I do appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, let's just get right out of the shot, right out of the shoot here. How can people check out your blog? I think you've written some fascinating stories. I went and checked out your stuff in preparation for this interview. And I know as the listeners listen to you, they're going to say, I want to check this guy out. So right out of the top, and it'll be in our show notes as well. But how can our listeners find you?
I think the easiest way is to follow on social media. I'm pretty active on Twitter, on Instagram.
Okay.
At Darren Heitner. That's DarrenHeitner. And I'm also active on LinkedIn. And obviously, you can just find me by typing in my name. Yep.
LinkedIn. I have been on LinkedIn for probably, 5 years. I don't think I've actually used it once. I need to start using it. I've been told that is the way to go. Marketing people, they use LinkedIn. I got to use it. But you find it's actually beneficial.
I have. You know, I think that the stigma for LinkedIn for a long time has been it's a job search engine, that people
right.
who are looking for opportunities will go to LinkedIn, and that's its primary purpose. And it may be. But I've brought in quite a bit of work just from posting actively there and showcasing what we do at my law firm with athletes, with entertainers on intellectual property, et cetera. So I've found quite a bit of value from it.
Wow. And that's when I went over your site, in my mind, what I thought was this guy is living the dream. In fact, you even mentioned some things on your site about, I think, Just Do Something. Talk a little bit about how you got to your law firm. I know where you are now is you are a big success. We're going to go over some of your clients. One client in particular, a couple of clients I really am very fascinated by. I'm a KU grad. You probably already know which client I'm going to talk about. But nonetheless, when you were growing up, did you see the movie, what is it? Show Me the Money. What is the name of that movie?
Jerry Maguire.
Yes. Did you see that growing up?
Of course. I think everyone saw it. In fact, if you haven't, then you need to turn on TNT because I think they show it every other week now. Great movie. It has caused, I think, a lot of people to be very fascinated and interested in the sports agency world. It certainly piqued my interest. I was a sports agent at one point in time. I was representing athletes in connection with their contracts with teams, as well as their off-field, off-court deals. It's actually something I don't do at all anymore. A lot of those agents are now my clients. But yeah, look, that was a movie that brought to light, I think, a part of the sports world, and maybe not only brought to light the sports agency profession, but made people interested in sports business. And in fact, I think, led to me being able to write at Forbes Inc. magazine, Above the Law, as you mentioned, because there just are so many people that are not only interested in what happens on the field of play or on the court, but what happens outside of it as well from a business and legal perspective.
Now, I want to get to the sports law aspect because there's a lot of questions I want to explore. But before we get there, again, I want to know, and for my attorney listeners, they want to know, did you chart this course out? I mean, where you are now with your owning your own firm, doing sports law, and all these other aspects that you do, Is that what you dreamed of doing when you were a kid? Did you want to be a sports athlete when you were a kid? Yeah. I mean, how did it come to be that you are now doing what you've always wanted to do?
No, I think what's interesting, and you talk to a lot of people in various areas of the practice of law or even in the sports world, and you find that many of them didn't plan any sort of course to get to where they are today. And I think that's somewhat true for me. I never actually, when I went to law school and I started in 2007, graduated in 2010, prior to that and through my 3 years of law school, I never thought I was actually going to practice law. I went to law school for multiple reasons, one of which is that I guess I wanted to stall being a real person.
Some truth there. There's some truth and honesty in this podcast. I love that. I didn't want to face the real world. Let's just keep going to school.
Yeah, that's one reason. And the other thing was I wanted to be a sports agent, as I mentioned before. So I thought that it would be helpful to have that legal background if I was going to be in the realm of negotiating contracts, perhaps drafting contracts and so on and so forth, and that it would make me more marketable as I went out to try to procure clients to represent. And so here
I am.
Now,
did you play sports?
Yeah, I do play recreationally. I played in high school. I was captain of the volleyball team, and that's saying a lot for someone who's 5'7", 5'8", on a good day, right? So played baseball growing up. But I went to the University of Florida, which I believe is the best school in the country for college sports, and certainly one of the top ones for football, baseball, basketball. And so I had no shot to ever play on one of their teams. But I played intramurals. I never thought that I was going to be a professional athlete. No.
Really? So, even as a young kid, when you were playing baseball for whatever little league, you didn't in your mind think, okay, I'm going to be a professional baseball player someday?
I thought that it was possible. I'm super competitive. I think when I did not grow as much as I had hoped, I realized that it was not in the cards. And so actually at one point in time, I was so enamored by sports and continue to be to this day that I thought that I was going to be a sports doctor. I thought maybe that path in medicine would work for me. And then very quickly realized I squirm when I see blood. Today, when I get blood drawn from me, I almost faint. So
another reason why we took the LSAT and not the MCAT, we have this aversion for blood and guts. And we'll just see.
I can't even do personal injury lie. I just can't look at that kind of stuff.
Right. So I find it fascinating because a lot of guys in particular, when we were young, we dreamed of a life in sports. I mean, I was going to be a professional baseball player. I was going to be a professional basketball player. Turns out you got to be fast. You got to be able to jump. And so I could not do either one of those. I was not fast and I couldn't jump. But there was a moment in your life when you realized, okay, maybe sports isn't in it for me. Maybe that's not my career. But it would be nice to have a career touching sports, because that is a passion of so many people, and at least you found a way to do that. And so now you went to law school then at the University of Florida. Now, this obviously is an interest of mine because I'm a big football fan. I love Tim Tebow. Were you in school there at Florida when Tebow was the quarterback?
I was. So I was there for 7 years. I went straight through from undergrad to law school.
Okay.
And so I had the unique opportunity to attend for 2 football national championships and 2 basketball national championships.
That's right. And Billy Donovan.
Yeah. Billy D was there. It was the glory days. I don't know. It's hard to compare it to any set of 7 years that anyone else could have experienced at any university. I don't know what you would potentially compare it to not only have such dominance in one sport, but 2 sports and the 2 most, really the most important sports on every college campus. So it was awesome. I mean, I'm so thankful to just really have been lucky in attending at just the perfect time.
Now, I'm going to butcher these names, but I lived in Florida at that time as well, and I remember before Urban Meyer came to be the coach, was it Ron Zook? I think he's a great guy, great coach, but he did not have the success that Floridians expected from their college football program, and so he was shown the door. They brought in Urban Meyer. I mention that because I'm also a Nebraska Cornhusker fan, and people say, oh, Nebraska, when are they ever going to reclaim their glory? Will they ever do it? It's like Alabama was not Alabama between, you know, whoever their famous coach was and Nick Saban. I mean, in Florida, you bring in one coach like Urban Meyer, he changes everything. So you really, you're only one coach away from your glory days. But
well, you know what's interesting about that? And this is said in all walks of life. It's like, you know, sometimes presidents inherit a strong economy from the prior president. It just takes some time to work out. What Ron Zook may not get enough credit for on the national level, but I think a lot of Gators fans do recognize, is that from 2002 to 2004, when he was head coach of the football team, his success won't be shown in the record books, but he was an amazing recruiter. And so a coach like Urban Meyer, who followed, was the benefactor of some of the amazing recruiting classes that he brought in. And then you had Urban Meyer, who just happens to be an incredible coach. And so he was able to get these very talented players out of high school to come together and work towards a national championship or two national championships. So, but Ron Zook, you know, he doesn't get enough credit for one component of the game, which was very important in college sports, that being recruiting.
It used to be all about recruiting. Again, I'm a big Nebraska Cornhusker fan. And back in the day, the joke was, you know, the Oklahoma Sooners, their players would never go pro early. They just couldn't afford it, the pay cut. And so I know it's a little bit different now with recruiting than what it was back in the 70s and 80s. But nonetheless, those are good times. Florida, SEC, you guys are having another great year this year. My Nebraska Cornhuskers not doing as well. But I am one of these eternal optimists. I kid you not, Darren. I actually had a conversation earlier this week with someone about, okay, is there still a path for Nebraska to be in the BCS this year? Is there any kind of path? That's how delusional I am when it comes to my sports teams. I never give up, but hey, there's always next year.
You're so delusional that you're still calling it the BCS. It's not the BCS anymore. It's the College Football Playoff.
That's right.
I think with a record of what, 1-4, that Nebraska, you should probably start thinking about next year.
Yeah, I tell you what. You know what? If everyone else gets COVID, gets knocked out, maybe there's a shot for that. But no, your sports agent blog, I checked it out. It's very interesting. And from a lawyer's perspective and also a fan's perspective, I really enjoyed reading it. Again, that has to be a dream job for every wannabe jock. Now, how did you come up with your catchphrase or your, I don't know what you want to call it, but just do something? I like that. How did you come up with that?
I don't even remember, to be honest, when I crafted that concept. But I know that for many years, people would give me some praise for the fact that I'm not one to sit on ideas. And I constantly, when I'm talking to younger people who are oftentimes coming to me for advice on how to break into the industry or how to get themselves known or brand themselves, I say, you know, look, there are so many people in this world who have come up with tremendous ideas, and we'll never know who they are or what their concept was. And it's unfortunate because there's so many, and forget about just from a monetary perspective, but just to change the world for the better. There are so many incredible ideas that we all have. And unfortunately, for whatever reason it may be, it could be a lack of resources or simply a fear for failure, we fail to act on them. And I think that's what's so important about that phrase, just do something. And obviously it's a play on Nike's phrase, just do it. Because from my perspective, who the hell knows what it is? So So don't wait to somehow and believe that at some point in time you're going to receive verification that your idea is going to be successful. You won't know unless you try it out. And that's the whole concept surrounding just do something.
I like that. It makes me think of the concept of paralysis by analysis. So sometimes we analyze things so much, like, which way should I go? It's like, you know what? It doesn't matter. Pick one and do it well. That's really what is more important. Whatever road you take, do it and enjoy the journey and do it well. You know, give it your best. And then I do like just do something. Now, again, you are in sports law, and I'm a huge sports fan, as I've already mentioned, and so that's why I really was looking forward to this podcast. I want to talk COVID for just a bit. Sure. How does COVID impact the sports world? It's just this past week, we've seen some monumental impacts when it comes to COVID. I'm thinking of Ohio State had to cancel its game, and now they might not even qualify for the Big Ten Championship, which might take them out of the playoffs. Definitely takes them out of the BCS, as you just pointed out. That would have been several years ago. But hey, I'm already to that age. I know you're much younger. I'm already to that age where if I say something like, oh, yeah, it just happened a couple weeks ago, it very well could be it happened 2 years ago. But to me, it was 2 weeks ago in my mind because I have no concept of time. But we had the whole, you know, college playoffs with COVID. Then you also have the Denver Broncos. Have you ever seen anything like that where you have a NFL football game with no quarterbacks?
No, it was incredible. Quarterback, they brought up a player who was on the practice squad, who I think was originally designated as a wide receiver, but played some quarterback either in college or prior to that. And the stat line was one completion, two interceptions. I think it may have been the first time that a quarterback threw more interceptions than completions in a game. So it was, you know, a lot of people were actually interested in the game just because of the sheer fact that we've never really seen anything like it before. It ended up being a terrible game to watch.
And I think Chicago fans were saying, is he available? Can we pick him up this week? If you ever cut him, we might have room for him on our squad. But from your perspective, how are you seeing COVID impact the sports world, either from a legal perspective or just as a fan's perspective?
Yeah, I mean, from a fan's perspective, obviously, with regard to the NBA that continued and ended its season in a bubble, there were no fans until the very end, and then it was on a very limited basis. Even right now, as the NBA is planning to start back up this month of December, there are questions with regard to at what capacity stadiums will be filled with fans. And the same is true with this NFL season, where many of the stadiums are not allowing any fans there at all. Interestingly, just recently, San Francisco said that the team can't even play its games there. So now the remainder of the home games for the 49ers are actually going to be played in Arizona.
That's fascinating.
But so it's very interesting from a player and fan perspective. From a legal perspective, there's certainly there's been an increase in the types of contracts and waivers that are being created in the case that anyone ends up suffering from any harm related to coronavirus. We're seeing a lot of litigation surrounding insurance policies and whether or not there may be coverage for business interruption and so on and so forth. So there are certainly legal issues that have become noticeable based on the pandemic. And finally, I think it's caused everyone to reconsider their force majeure clauses that are found within contracts, which is essentially, you know, we're used to acts of God or terrorism, which, by the way, terrorism became a common element of force majeure after 9/11. So now we're seeing epidemic, pandemic language included in force majeure clauses as a result of this. And look, think back to this year. I mean, we're now at the end of 2020. And what's the one thing everyone's going to remember for the rest of time? It was the year of coronavirus. And so we've seen it play out in many aspects of the law.
I got to tell you, it is an amazing virus. I mean, I don't even understand it. I've been trying to follow this and trying to get my mind around it. And just from a personal standpoint, you know, you're paranoid about it. It's like, oh my goodness, if we catch it, we're going to end up in the hospital. What's going to go on? People are dying all over. And then my son plays soccer at his high school. And then it came out, there's an outbreak on a soccer team. So then my entire family gets it. That were at home. I have one son away in college, so he didn't get it. But those of us that are at the house all got it. And it was nothing more than the common cold. In fact, I told people, outside of the fact this was a global pandemic, if I had had a tennis match or a golfing event, I would have gone to it. There was never a time I would have actually stayed away and refused to do something outside of the fact that there's a national pandemic and someone else might catch this and then die from it. And so I'm going to, you know, not go out there. But how is this one virus, you know, killing people? And then for others, it's really just nothing. I have no idea.
Yeah, look, I mean, we're not medical professionals. It's very difficult to opine on it other than from what we read publicly and what we hear from people who are really experienced in those areas. My concern is not really for myself. It's that I don't want to be somebody who spreads it to an elderly right. population or an individual who may have a pre-existing condition. I think you make a very astute point, which is that, you know, the vast majority of individuals who have contracted the virus, and I think there's many more than what we even know right. that have even been reported, that it's just, you know, it could be akin to the common cold or perhaps worse, you know, loss of smell and taste for some time or aches and pains and so on and so forth. But not to the level of where it's a life or death situation. Whereas, you know, with the older population, which we have a large number of in South Florida where I reside, it can cause life and death. So that's the concern. That's the concern that everything's done to try to prevent that type of spread. And
From a legal perspective, do you think there is any liability to host an event and then have people come to that event and then pass COVID? So the sponsor of that event, is there any liability for hosting such an event? Or is that too attenuated that, well, I mean, have you seen any lawsuits that have made that claim?
No, I don't believe that I've seen any lawsuits yet. And I think as you and I both acknowledge and recognize, anyone can bring a lawsuit for anything.
Right, right,
and that
right.
includes frivolous lawsuits. And I doubt if someone contracts coronavirus and, let's say, attended a game in the recent past that it would be deemed frivolous. But at the same time, I do believe that that individual would have huge liability concerns in terms of actually establishing liability. I mean, first and foremost, causation. How do you prove that you actually contracted the virus based on going to that game, especially because, from my understanding, it takes some time for symptoms to be revealed, and it's really impossible to place a date on which the virus was contracted. But even if you can somehow establish liability, there's an excellent defense for an organization that's hosting an event, which is assumption of the risk. At this point, how do you not
at this
know,
point.
Right?
Right?
How do you not know that a pandemic exists, that it's very easily transferable, that it can cause harm, and that by going into a crowded area, even if there is distancing set up, that you're putting yourself out there in a position.
Oh, I know.
So, and then add on the waivers that people are required to sign. I think it would make for a very difficult case.
Now, are waivers effective? So let's say you want to run a sports league and everyone in the sports league, you're going to have them all sign a waiver saying if you catch COVID from or somehow injured that you can't sue us. Is that worth its weight in gold in court?
Very good question. And the case law varies jurisdiction to jurisdiction as to the enforceability of these types of waivers. And also it depends on the way in which the waiver is crafted. If it's, you know, precise and concise and, it's very specific as to what rights are being waived and it's not excessive, then in certain jurisdictions, there may be some weight attached to it. In others, it may not make any difference whatsoever. Oftentimes, it's more of a deterrent than anything. If an individual receives it, he or she may say, okay, well, do I want, knowing that I actually signed this or agreed to this language, am I now deterred from initiating litigation? So it varies.
I want to go over a couple of famous sports cases now, if we can, because I actually have a transition here, but I don't want to give out my transition just yet. But I want to go over some of these famous sports cases to see if you have a take on them. What is your position on them? Let's just start with Deflategate. I mean, obviously, so many people know about Deflategate. It dominated the news. I got to tell you, I watched it like a hawk. Do you know what surprised me most about Deflategate? Do you know who the lawyer was that the lawyers that argued Deflategate before the Second Circuit? Do you know who they were?
Oh, was it Ted Olson? Was he part of that?
Ted Olson and Paul Clement. You can't, if ESPN did a top 100 superpower lawyers in America, outside of you and I, it probably would be Paul Clement and Ted Olson. I mean, Paul Clement has argued more cases before the U.S. Supreme Court than any other lawyer alive today. Ted Olson was Bush v. Gore. He's the lawyer for the iPhone, right? The lawyer for Apple. These are the guys arguing over the deflation level of footballs. And so I find that fascinating. I wonder if Paul Clement's children said, hey, you know, Dad, yeah, I know you before the Supreme Court, but what was Tom Brady like? Can you tell me what that whole scenario was like? Well, what is your take on Deflategate?
You know, it was such a big deal that one of my colleagues, a professor, I believe he's at New Hampshire now, is Michael McCann. He created a course around it in law school. So if you have the opportunity of going there, you could actually take a semester to learn the nuances.
Because there's actually some real law from the Deflategate.
I know. I mean, I remember just the controversy in itself and Brady unwilling to accept a suspension of four games, but ultimately being required to. And the issue over evidence and the Wells report and so on and so forth. I mean, it's sort of, I mean, what is that, 4 years ago now or maybe even more?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, they won the...
But now you hear the name Tom Brady and do you even think about it? I know I don't. Actually, what I think is, did he ruin his legacy by leaving the Patriots to go to the Buccaneers for a year or two?
I still call them the McCheaters, but nonetheless, I get that they,
interesting time. That's for sure. You know, and the battles between the league and the Players Association and Tom Brady, you know, the biggest name in football, certainly now and perhaps in the history of the game, being front and center. It was, you know, and he was fighting. I remember this was his reputation more than anything.
Yes. And I followed that case very closely. And my two thoughts, parting thoughts, because Deflategate still is alive today. But here are my two takeaways from Deflategate. First of all, I do think Tom Brady did not order the footballs to be deflated. I really do think this was done just by those ball handlers who thought, I think Tom Brady likes the ball slightly deflated. He's kind of made that known, so I'm going to deflate these a little bit because I think it's going to help out my boss. But I don't think Tom Brady actually ordered anyone to deflate the footballs. So that's my first takeaway. The second takeaway is this is still alive today. I mean, this could rear its ugly head in the next CBA because what the courts ruled there was, look, players, I get it. Tom Brady had no due process rights. He could not depose. The Wells report looks like it was a rigged thing against him. I get all that. But you know what? You gave that power to Roger Goodell. So if you have any beef, it's with you, yourselves. And so the proper time to argue this is the next CBA. Don't give the commissioner that much power next time. But this one's on you. So Deflategate is alive and well because the next CBA, that very well might be the issue. Or it just might be so long gone no one even cares about it because new things will be important, like money, the next time around.
That's a common conversation in inner circles in the world of sports business, and in particular people who deal with football players, teams, etc., is that, you know, as you astutely mentioned, this is more than anything a collective bargaining issue, and with regard specifically to how power is apportioned in the grievance process. And you're right. I mean, essentially what the players have given up over time is control to Roger Goodell, the commissioner of the NFL, to essentially be judge, jury, and executioner. And every time that there are new collective bargaining discussions, this comes up tangentially. And it's never one of the more serious issues for the players. Ultimately, the biggest issue, obviously, is always the split of revenue between the players and the owners. But then more recently, in the last round of negotiations, it was about, you know, how many games would be played in a given season because the NFL wanted it to be increased to 17. And then obviously, again, it was right at the time that coronavirus was becoming serious. There were a lot of questions surrounding that as well. But this issue over control over the grievance process is something that everyone in the know in the world of sports is aware of, and the players are aware of. It just unfortunately has never been a priority.
Is it one of those things where the players are going to say, all right, Roger, you want this power, you want to keep this power, then show us the money. How much money are you going to give us? We want an increase in revenue, or there's got to be a payoff on our end in some way in monetary value if you want to keep that power. It's just going to be a negotiating point at the next CBA that might be resolved with just giving the players more money. I don't know. I'm just guessing there. I have no idea how that's going to turn out.
It becomes an issue whenever there's discipline. And then for some reason, it's forgotten about when the CBA conversations occur again. And maybe not forgotten about, but again, it's not a priority. And that's the problem. And then we hear the moaning and groaning when there is a high-profile issue, such as a Deflategate type of issue. And we remember as a whole that this is something that was bargained for and that it's impossible to avoid.
And think about it, how many players actually face discipline. I'm just going to make this up, but let's just say it's 10. All right. How many players are actually in the NFL that can vote on the CBA? I mean, 500,
53 players on each roster.
All right. Times 30. Was it?
Yeah. And then they look at, there's an additional number of players who are free agents that have the ability to vote on it. So it's roughly 2000 players, I believe, maybe a bit less.
I'm totally making these numbers up, but just to prove a point, let's just say you have a handful of 10 players who face discipline. You got 2,000 who are voting. If you give those other 1,990 players extra money, yeah, you know what? Those 10 players, they don't need due process. They need to keep their nose clean next time. I want the more money. That's what's more important to me. I mean, who knows how that's going to play out, but you can definitely see that becoming an issue that that more money might just resolve.
And the bigger issue is the glaring disparity between the haves and the quote-unquote have-nots. The vast majority of players who are at or near minimum salary, and then the Tom Brady's of the world who are making millions of dollars per year. And so it may be a bigger concern for those individuals who have more to lose with a suspension. Hey, look, we just saw two players on the Houston Texans suspended 6 games each for performing enhancement drug abuse.
Right, good point.
And that's a huge hit to an individual's paycheck. Now, the hit's bigger if you're making more money. And so obviously those players who are making more may be more concerned with that type of language in the collective bargaining agreement, whereas the minimum salary players are saying, hey, any bump in pay is much more important to me than if I happen to have an issue with the league or a team.
So I'm curious about this because I think we all can see there's a difference between those players who are, for lack of a better term, made players. In other words, not only is their wealth guaranteed, the wealth of their fourth generation is guaranteed, right? They made so much money. If they lose a half a season salary, you know what? It doesn't make a difference. Their great-great-grandkids are still driving Ferraris. As compared to the player who maybe is 1 year in and they're going to make $500,000 or whatever the minimum salary is a lot of money, but it's still not generational changing. It's not even life-changing money. That just helps you buy a nicer car and a house, maybe, or put a down payment on a house. So here's my question for you. What is the vote total like? I assume when does a player have one vote in the CBA? Do they have to be drafted, play for a team? Do you know how that works?
With regard to eligibility to vote?
Right.
Yeah, so players who are not yet actually drafted or ever signed to a contract with a team do not have rights to vote. And there are distinctions between the various sports. For instance, in baseball, even if you are drafted, you're not part of the bargaining unit until you're added to a 40-man roster. So anyone familiar with baseball's farm system, there are numerous minor league teams within the organization. And so until you're on the 40-man roster, you don't have rights and you're not considered part of the bargaining unit. When you are retired, you're also no longer considered part of the bargaining unit. So using the NFL, since we've been talking about it thus far as an example, as I mentioned, if you're on a 53-man roster, you are absolutely part of the bargaining unit. But also, if you've played in the league, and I believe if you are just becoming a free agent and there are negotiations occurring surrounding the CBA. There are qualifications that do allow you to vote. And I say that because I'm aware this past year, when there was an extension to the pre-existing CBA, there were conversations about whether certain people outside the 53-man roster should be able to vote. And the focus was right on those individuals who were free agents, had not been added to a roster, but had recent playing experience with an NFL team.
So we can pretty much agree here that that 53rd person on the roster, his vote counts just as much as Tom Brady's vote. Is that right?
100%. Yes, it's 1-1. Now, there may be more influence by certain individuals, certainly a Tom Brady who has 20 years experience in the league and has accumulated a massive amount of money and success in right. the league. But also there's player reps on each team. There are individuals who are designated as the player representatives for the collective of players within that organization. And so because they are so connected to the Players Association, because they're more involved and perhaps have a better appreciation of the issues, their opinion may sway others within the organization as well.
Okay, and that so you could see how that 53rd person, that person's interest, a little bit different than maybe a Tom Brady.
They're not
made people. They just want a paycheck. They can't really pay off their I don't even know what kind of car you want to mention that they would buy, but it's just totally different money than someone who's worth over $100 million.
Without a doubt.
Fascinating. All right. How about this case here? I'm just going to test your sports knowledge here, but your law knowledge, I guess. Slugger, do you hear about the lawsuit? I'm from Kansas City. Slugger is our mascot in Kansas City. Have you ever been to a Kansas City Royals game?
I have not.
I highly encourage you. It's an amazing stadium. If you ever get out to Kansas City, I'll take you out there. It's a great place to watch a ball game. Slugger is our mascot. Well, we do the hot dog launch, where you put these hot dogs in this little cannon, if you will, and you shoot it out, and they'll go up to the upper deck, right? Have you seen that hot dog launch?
I have. Yes.
Okay, so that's what he did. Well, there was a person not paying attention and kind of like turned their head or something like that. Slugger shot the hot dog towards that person, hit them in the face, and that person then sued Slugger and sued the Kansas City Royals for injuries caused from this hot dog that was shot out of a cannon. And so I don't know if you've seen similar kind of legal issues across the United States, but generally speaking, I'm not asking you to be an expert on Missouri law, but just generally speaking, how do you think the law should play out in that kind of context?
You know, I do recall that's like a 5-6 year old case, no?
Right, exactly.
Okay, I recall, I don't remember exactly how it did play out or if it's even still on appeals, which is possible, you know, even 5-6 years later. But right. I do recall that there was a discussion about inherent risk in attending
exactly.
the game, right?
And is so, a hot dog launch an inherent risk in the game of baseball? You nailed it.
And that's a really good question, right? Because it's pretty clear that, well, and it hasn't been completely clear because there's disparity in opinions in the past, and that's why we've seen an expansion of the net surrounding right. the fans. But even there, I would say it's pretty clear that if you attend a game, you're at risk of being hit by a foul ball.
Right.
But if there's disparity amongst the jurisdictions in that, and a consequence of that has been an increase in the amount of territory covered by these nets, then certainly you would say that there's less of an inherent risk of being hit by a hot dog in the eye.
Right.
And you can
go to a baseball game and not see a hot dog launch. I guess that's what you're saying. That's not inherent to the game of baseball.
I mean, I'm not going to a game with the expectation of being smacked in the eye with some sauerkraut. That's for sure.
Right.
So, yeah, I suppose that that's a fair conclusion, at least. And again, it's been some time since I remember looking at that case, but at least it's not a decision that should have been made, let's say, on a motion for summary judgment. I don't think that there's a clear interpretation of the law, even with an absence of material facts being in dispute. I think that's something that probably has to go to the jury.
Yeah, so it went up on appeal, and the appeals court ruled that a hot dog launch is not an inherent risk into the game of baseball. So for that reason alone, there's no liability. But then it got sent back to trial to find out, well, even so, were they negligent in how they did the hot dog launch? And so it was a slightly different issue there. All right, another one here, since we're talking about food. And
did the guy who got hit by the hot dog receive any damages?
I don't know if it got settled, but after it was up on appeal, he the court ruled that it's not a risk inherent to the game of baseball. So therefore, that would indicate that the Kansas City Royals then lost that claim because they couldn't just say throw this case out. So it got sent back, and then I have not followed it since it got sent back. So it probably settled out at that point in time. My guess is
interesting. All right, what's the next one?
Since we're talking about food, Mike Tyson, did you watch his latest fight?
I didn't, but I heard that it wasn't. Oh. I didn't miss much. The only thing I missed was great commentary by Snoop Dogg.
Hey, you know what? Since I am, since 50 is within my purview, I could be a professional boxer because this was a 51-year-old boxing and 54-year-old guy. So maybe I could still be a professional athlete after all. But let's go back several years. Mike Tyson was fighting Evander Holyfield. And early on in the fight, he got the munchies and then took a bite out of Evander Holyfield's ear. Do you remember that?
I sure do. How could anyone forget?
And so here's what happened. People paid $100 or whatever for pay-per-view. People paid for thousands of dollars for ringside seats, right, to watch this boxing match. Instead, they saw a hot dog eating contest. They said, this isn't right. And so they sued Mike Tyson and the promoters, saying, look, you owe us back our money. We paid to see a fight. And we just saw some kind of, you know, Mike Tyson chomping on Evander Holyfield's ear. So that was the lawsuit. And so do you have any idea how the law should be applied? Should someone who buys a ticket be able to get reimbursed if they don't see a fairly fought contest?
My opinion is absolutely not. And I would assume that that case was just thrown out of court pretty quickly, unless it was somehow settled. No, because when you're purchasing a ticket to a sporting event or you're purchasing a pay-per-view, you're purchasing a license to view, essentially, or you're purchasing a seat license in the case of going to a specific game. But you're not receiving consideration in the form of some sort of guaranteed result. What you're guaranteed is entertainment. And so if a game is canceled altogether, then certainly I can, or a fight, I can understand a right to reimbursement. But certainly I would actually make the claim that people who paid for the pay-per-view and watched that live received a lot more entertainment value than what they would have received if the fight actually went all, or if that did not occur.
That was money well spent.
So yeah, I can't imagine that something like that would ever result in relief for the plaintiffs.
Well, Darren, you are two for two because you're absolutely right. The court held that, look, when you buy a ticket, you're not buying a ticket to see a game played by some set of rules. It's more appropriately viewed as a license to be on that site at that particular time.
I don't want your listeners to think that we planned this, by the way.
That's right. No, you are too. No, actually, there are a couple other very similar cases. One, IndyCar did a race, and I believe it was Goodyear Tire, one of the tire companies. Their tires were bad, and so there were only six cars that went around that track. And a lawsuit was filed saying, look, this is not an IndyCar race. You only have six cars that are allowed to go around the track. And the court said, nope, you got a license. You're sitting there in the seat. So whatever you see is whatever you see. And so a lot of similar cases like that. But yeah, unfortunately, which kind of bums me out because I would love to sue whenever my team doesn't play like I want them to play or give the effort I want them to give. But
emotional distress, right?
Exactly. You're brilliant. I like these ideas. All right. Now, I don't want you to obviously say anything that you can't say, but on your website, you have some famous clients listed. In particular, I'm looking at one client, Andrew Wiggins. Are you excited about the year he's going to have this year? He was just signed by or traded to Golden State, right?
He was, yeah.
I'm excited about that. Andrew Wiggins, we went to the you know, over at Allen Fieldhouse where KU plays, they have this thing called late night, you know, where you, the very first day you can actually can practice. So we went because Andrew Wiggins was gonna, that's gonna be his first day as a KU Jayhawk. But nonetheless, I'm excited to see his, see if he's gonna be have a good year this year, maybe kind of live up to his promise. I also see in your clients Antonio Brown, which is fascinating to me. He's back in the NFL, though the Chiefs handled him last week. And Anna Kournikova. Wow, that was a name from the past.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she, I with regard to Anna, you know, and with Andrew, we assisted with transactional related matters. So,
okay.
I won't get into the specifics of those, but all good things. I can't necessarily say the same with regard to Antonio Brown, where I was in a position where I was handling quite a bit of litigation for him as well. But at this point, after roughly 2 years of working with him, we are no longer his legal counsel. And in fact, we're coming up on a year, which is kind of crazy since I withdrew from representing him. And I can't say that I've done that many times in my 10-plus year career as a lawyer, but I think it was for the best, and it was really something that needed to be done at the time.
Yes, they. So I've had to withdraw from one particular client, and that is always an interesting ordeal. But you have a fascinating list of clients there. Now, before we go here, I thank you so much for your time. But I do have to know a couple of things here. Do you have a favorite legal movie and or a favorite legal TV show?
I liked Suits a lot until the very
that's great.
End. I don't know, like the last season or two, just it seemed as though they were dragging it as far as it could possibly go. And it was time for it to end. But
it was that dang Queen of England that kind of ruined everything, right?
I know.
Once you pulled out the main guy from the show, it was not the same show.
No, but I tend to not really enjoy legal TV shows and that was probably my favorite for many years. And then on a movie, I mean, how can you not say My Cousin Vinny?
All right. Yeah, that is the best. Yeah. Oh, and there's so many great lines from My Cousin Vinny. Marissa Tomei tapping her foot, saying my biological clock is ticking. Or the ute. What is a ute? I mean, so many great lines from My Cousin Vinny.
Yeah.
I teach CLEs for lawyers, so continuing legal education classes, and we like to use more, you know, humorous things in our classes. And I think My Cousin Vinny can teach its own class. You can just walk in there, hit play, watch the movie, walk out, and get 2 good hours of credit because it's a great movie. A judge, you know who Judge Posner is? He was a retired judge now from the Seventh Circuit, known for his notorious bench slaps. He actually wrote an article saying that My Cousin Vinny is a great teaching tool. You learn a lot about the practice of law just from watching that movie. So
I'll throw in another one, actually, a show that I just finished. It's a 6-episode, I guess, short series called The Undoing on HBO.
Undoing. Okay.
And it has Hugh Grant. It has Nicole Kidman, Donald Sutherland. And there's a lot of the episodes revolve around a court case. And I thought that was really interesting to watch. So it just happens to be a great show.
Nice. All right. I mean, we've all had this experience through the pandemic. We've binge watched everything now.
Yes.
We are needing new shows. And so, hey, The Undoing.
Watch that. Very good.
I'll watch it. Well, thank you so much, Darren, for being on. I do appreciate your time. And good luck to you and good luck to Andrew Wiggins. And we will talk to you later.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review. We need your love to help us continue highlighting the funnier side of the law. I want to give a special shout out to our Vice President of Operations, Wendy Oster, without whom this entire operation would be a mess, Sean Wynn, and 15.5 Features for making me sound way better than I actually do, Brooke Bolin for spreading the good word about us, and Ryan Kuhn and Paul Kuhn of Triplicity Marketing for our technical and computer support.